This is a CBC podcast.
An election on the price on pollution? We had three, Mr. Speaker, and we won them all.
Wow. Then he shouldn't be afraid to have one more.
Kill or keep it. Either way, there's lots of big talk about the carbon tax. As more and more politicians reject it, is the tax toast? I'm Catherine Cullen, and this week on The House, former Premiers Jason Kenney and Kathleen Wynne together with two very different views on the best path forward. Plus, it was an action-packed week in Parliament. The motion on Gaza, new restrictions on immigration, and more sketchy allegations involving government contracts. First, though, can Trudeau keep the carbon tax on track? The House is now in session.
We as common sense conservatives are saying no to Trudeau's 23% April Fool's Day increase. We are saying spike the hike until we common sense conservatives can axe the tax.
Axe the tax, spike the hike, they might be Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre's favorite phrases. The federal carbon tax is set to rise April 1st. That means, for example, gas costs will go up by about 3 cents a liter. But Canadians will also see their rebate checks get bigger, too. Still, the federal Conservatives aren't the only ones taking aim at the tax. Seven premiers have now voiced concerns. So why does support for the carbon tax seem to be crumbling? Could it be on its way out entirely? We have two former premiers here to discuss. Jason Kenney was the Premier of Alberta from 2019 to 2022, and he also served in Prime Minister Stephen Harper's cabinet. Kathleen Wynne was the Premier of Ontario from 2013 to 2018 and was there when the carbon tax on the federal level was introduced. Welcome to the House to you both.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Catherine.
Kathleen Wynne, I want to start with you and ask you that question of why it seems that the support for the carbon tax is waning so dramatically right now.
So, Catherine, let me just start by saying that I was a fan of cap and trade. We implemented a cap and trade system in Ontario. And so I always thought that that was the more elegant carbon pricing solution. So I just need to get that on the record.
Okay.
I think that there are a couple of things going on. To his, I don't know, credit or discredit, I think Pierre Poilievre has been very successful in weaponizing the whole conversation around carbon pricing, but particularly the carbon tax. And I think that there have been inconsistencies in the federal application of the carbon tax, and certainly in the communication of the efficacy and the rebate system and so on. But the carve-out for home heating fuel, I think, was very confusing to people. So I think those things are coming together with the cost of living, which obviously is a challenge across the country. So I think that's what's going on. I also think, and I'll end with this, is I think that we're having the wrong conversation, Catherine. I think that we should be talking about and focusing on the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions rather than a specific mechanism. So that's what I'm worried about.
Okay, we are definitely going to talk about mechanisms in a moment. But Jason Kenney, I want to stay with this question. I mean, the federal Liberals have argued, listen, we had numerous election campaigns around the carbon tax and, you know, people voted them back into power. Why is the argument against it getting traction now, do you think?
Well, in the last two of those elections, they won with like 31% of the vote, the lowest ever to result in a government in Canadian history. So I don't think that's exactly a huge mandate. And, you know, when the carbon tax started out at a relatively low level that wasn't obviously noticeable to people, it wasn't a big ballot question. But that's changing as the price increases, as the tax increases. And let's be clear, like their stated explicit plan is to take it to at least $170 a ton. That's tripling it from where it is today. And then Environment Canada says that still won't be adequate. In fact, Stephen Guibeau said the other day that it hasn't really begun to work. It's going to take until 2060. So people are starting to catch on in the context of a cost of living crisis. Ordinary Canadian families are struggling to pay their grocery bills, their rent bills, their mortgage payments.
But isn't this, sorry, Jason Kenney, isn't this where the rebate is supposed to kick in, right? I mean, there's supposed to be an antidote to that in the way this program is designed.
Well, people aren't falling for the shell game. You know, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, and I'm quoting directly here because there's been a lot of back and forth on this. I'm quoting from their report, March 30 of last year, When both fiscal and economic impacts of the federal fuel charge are considered, we estimate that most households will see a net loss, paying more in fuel charges and GST, as well as receiving lower incomes compared to the climate action incentive payments they receive and lower personal income taxes they pay. So last year, that was nearly $500 less, net hit to the wallet of an Ontario family, $710 in Alberta, and it's only just beginning. And I think people are saying, well, what is all of this for? And by the way, as Kathleen said, the government has claimed there's some huge moral imperative that this thing has to happen, except where they have a caucus revolt in Atlantic Canada. So it's actually all politics at the end of the day. I think that just underscores that this is incoherent. And finally, they're losing a lot of the, I would say, elite opinion support that used to exist around the carbon tax that came from a lot of centrist and free market leaning economists that thought this was better than Kathleen's idea of a cap and trade or regulations. But they're doing all the regulations anyway. So it's not the pure Pigouvian tax that a lot of clever people supported initially. So I think it's falling apart because of the cost, because of the political inconsistency, and because they're doing this plus everything else on top of it, which is hammering the economy.
Politically, when we are seeing this loss of support, can Justin Trudeau back away from this policy, which has been a marquee policy for his government? Kathleen?
What I think is that no government in this country should be backing away from the fight against climate change. You know, I'm not going to pretend that the government's not in a hard place on this. I totally get that. I mean, you know, there was a non-confidence vote this week. We obviously are in a very difficult moment in terms of those of us who believe that the federal government should play a role in fighting climate change. So I don't know what they're going to do. I think that Trudeau has been very, very clear that he's going to continue the fight against climate change. I think what's missing from Jason's analysis is the, you know, the really single-minded and simple-minded political focus by the opposition on this, as I said before, weaponizing the whole notion of carbon pricing. And that, you know, to me, that is irresponsible politics. But, you know, we can have that discussion again.
Irresponsible, why?
Well, because we should be talking about the whole issue. So, you know, Jason talks about the cost of living. The fact is that on average, insurance costs have gone up 8% just in the past year and 10% in some parts of the country. So the impacts of climate change have to be taken into account when we talk about the upfront costs. And that's often left out of the conversation. So those entire costs to the society have to be part of the discussion, which is why I don't think that the federal government can afford to step back completely from carbon pricing. Exactly how they'll manage that, how they'll navigate it, I don't know, Catherine, but it would be irresponsible, I think, not to continue that battle. And the reality is, if they step aside, then the provincial governments are going to have to step up because the fight has to continue.
Okay, Jason Kenney, I want to bring you back in here, and I do want to ask you about the actions of a particular provincial government and all this, which is Saskatchewan. Premier Scott Moe refusing to collect and remit the carbon tax on home heating. That's breaking the law. And I wonder what you make of that decision to push back in this debate.
Well, the premier and his, by the way, that was adopted unanimously by the Saskatchewan legislature, including the NDP opposition, and has the overwhelming support of Saskatchewan voters, residents. This is affecting Saskatchewan and Alberta, by the way, disproportionately. And they do have a provincial crown that collects the tax. So that will be litigated. By the way, I mean, you want to talk about breaking the law. The federal government brought in the Impact Assessment Act, which was struck down by the Supreme Court of Canada as being an unconstitutional violation of provincial jurisdiction. They still haven't changed that.
Right. But so I guess, Jason Kenney, I guess what I would say about that is like that's the process we're used to in this country is that, you know, laws are put forward by legislatures and they're challenged in the courts. It's a different thing when a provincial government says we're going to ignore this law, isn't it?
So this, you know, obviously the federal government will challenge it. This will go to the courts. And ultimately, these things will be litigated by voters at the ballot box. I'd just like to come back to something that Kathleen said a moment ago. She characterized opponents of the government's position on carbon taxes as simple-minded. I quite frankly think that that kind of arrogant posturing towards people who are struggling to pay their energy bills is part of what's driving this 70% national opposition to higher carbon taxes. Now, I agree with Kathleen that we
you know
do
that's
need to
not
take
what I said. You know that's not what I said, Jason. You know I did not say anything about the people who are struggling. I was talking about the politics being played by Pierre Poilievre at the national level, and it is a simple-minded attack on okay. the fight against climate change. So just to be clear.
Okay. I know what people at home want to hear is how do we address this fundamental issue of reducing our emissions? And we only have a couple of minutes left. Jason, I did interrupt you there. So Jason Kenney, if not a carbon tax, I mean, the alternatives are heavy regulation or massive investments in technology. What is the best route forward if we do want to live up to our commitments and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions?
Investments in technology. Alberta was the first jurisdiction in North America to develop a industrial carbon tax. The revenues have been invested in cutting-edge carbon sequestration technology and other technologies. The Oil Sands Pathways Group is very deeply committed to decarbonization. But let's put some perspective in this. Canada's responsible for 1.5% of global emissions. You could eliminate the Canadian economy tomorrow and would have no meaningful impact on global emissions. China is 27% and rising. And policies like this carbon tax lead to carbon leakage. We don't tax. We don't impose a carbon tariff on imports from places like China, which means it's cheaper to produce things there and ship them to Canada without a carbon tax on them. This isn't good economic policy.
We only have about a minute left, and I would like to get Kathleen's perspective on this. What is the best path forward, Kathleen Wynne?
So the Canadian Climate Institute came out this week and talked about industrial carbon pricing. And, you know, one of the things that I loved about cap and trade is that it was most effective dealing with those large emitters. That's where I think we have to go, whether it's cap and trade, whatever it is. But we need to put a price on industrial polluters. And I think that's the future. That's what we have to do. And that actually agrees with at least part of what Jason was talking about.
Okay. Obviously, the topic of some passionate discussion. Thank you both for giving us your perspectives today.
Thanks, Kathryn.
Thanks very much.
Former Premiers Jason Kenney and Kathleen Wynne. Well, another piece of the puzzle when it comes to lowering emissions might be hydrogen. On Monday, the federal government signed a new agreement to sell Canadian hydrogen to Germany. That is if this country's first ever hydrogen ammonia projects can get off the ground. CBC's Kenny Sharp reports now from Newfoundland on Atlantic Canada's hustle for hydrogen.
So over here, we have a mock nacelle system. It's just like a smaller version of a wind turbine.
Here in Stephenville, at the College of the North Atlantic, Alexander White is a student in the brand new wind turbine technician program. He and his fellow students have enrolled in this first ever class to learn how wind turbines work.
And then over here, we have three groups that are working on taking apart filters and pumps and other stuff to look at the internals and to be make sure that we are able to put them back together and just do some basic maintenance on them.
They're hoping to secure new jobs if hydrogen power becomes a reality in this province. Nearby, on the windy Port-au-Port Peninsula and Codroy Valley, Canadian company World Energy, GH2, wants to develop more than 300 wind turbines that would power a wind hydrogen ammonia mega project.
So we're here today because the team at World Energy GH2 is in a hurry. We need to get this project off the ground and signal to the world we are in the green hydrogen game now.
In February, Federal Labour Minister and Newfoundland MP Seamus O'Regan announced $128 million in loans for World Energy.
In Canada, in Deutschland, Kollege Jonathan Wilkinson.
And on Monday, Natural Resources Minister Jonathan Wilkinson flew to Hamburg, signing an updated MOU with Germany to sell Canadian hydrogen to Europe. Newfoundland and Labrador's provincial government says wind to hydrogen could be worth billions of dollars and employ thousands of people.
I think it's going to mean that Stephenville will grow. We started to lose some population. A lot of people left and moved to Alberta.
It's got the support of Mayor Tom Rose, who says the project would mean a boost to communities all along the coast, which has seen its share of ups and downs.
I'm very fortunate my two children live and work in Stephenville, but I know there are so many families that are torn apart because mom and dad have to travel. There's estimated 30,000 workers in Newfoundland and Labrador that either are rotational workers or seasonal workers because there's no work here for them. These jobs, because it's going to be high-paying jobs, professional jobs, semi-skilled jobs. That's going to pay some good wages.
But this plan still needs to pass a key hurdle, a provincial environmental assessment expected soon. And there are those who worry about the impact the hydrogen ammonia project will have on the local ecosystem.
This is the Cape St. George ecological sensitive area, which is proposed for government.
Yeah.
And this is our watershed right here. So you still have turbines still along the proposed watershed area, and that's still a concern. Because
local resident Marilyn Rowe is with a group called the Environmental Transparency Committee.
You know, we live in an area where the water runs from our mountains, and if anything is disrupted, you know, on the mountains, everything runs down. You know, it's a worry for our water here, because any watersheds should be no turbines, in my opinion.
Welcome to Western Newfoundland!
There have been protests at World Energy work sites. And just this month, one of the company's solar panels was vandalized.
Port of Port Peninsula, not for sale.
When I say green, you say support. Green! Support. Green!
But there have also been large rallies to support the project. Residents in Stephenville and area are also split on the issue.
I don't like it. We're going to lose our wood rights up there. Wildlife is going to be gone. No cutting wood no more. And no hunting. Now, another thing too, our water supply is going to be gone. Government's involved. I think it's still going to go through. But it's going to make it hard on everybody, right?
I agree 100%. You know, in a small town like this where it used to be booming, where we used to have money, it will help. And jobs, like I'm 24 going on myself, and it'd be nice to see a town where it once had money, have money again. And for us to have, the windmill project, I think it'd be a good idea.
I guess basically on two minds. I like what it's doing for the economy. It's a big boost for the economy. And on the other hand, it's the environment that people think about. So it's almost like you're between a rock and a hard place, but the economy, I guess, is the thing that matters the most.
I think we enjoy the support of the vast majority of the community in the area, but we do recognize there are individuals that still do not support the project.
Sean Leet is CEO of World Energy. He says the company is working to address residents' concerns.
A significant part of the work that was done around the environmental impact statement and the amendment in response to the guidelines that were issued by the province are specific to water. And if you look at the updated layout, you'll see that there are no turbines in, obviously, water reserve areas. We've paid particular attention to the concerns that have been addressed in that respect, and we're committed to doing no harm to the environment overall, but particularly to water supplies on the Port of Port.
Did you guys get your pressure?
Back at the College of the North Atlantic, Alexander White and his schoolmates are also looking to early April, not just because it's the end of term, but because that's when the provincial government here is expected to give its say on whether or not construction can start. And the first ever wind turbine technician class is hoping for a passing grade.
If World Energy's project goes ahead, like that could change how this whole area looks, right? Because there are already people interested in moving home to get jobs with it. Once you have more families here, you need more resources. Like maybe our hospital system could get more funding. We could get more restaurants, more recreational activities here, more disposable income, more people. It could have a very snowball effect, or like the rising tide rises all ships.
For the house, I'm Kenny Sharp in St. John's.
Coming up on the House podcast, on the day of his state funeral, a look at how Brian Mulroney's ambition for Canada changed this country and the political terrain for the prime ministers who followed. I'm Catherine Cullen. You're listening to the show that helps you make sense of the political decisions that affect your life. A new episode of The House drops every Saturday. Let us know what you think about what you hear. Send us an email, thehouse@cbc.ca, or leave us a review on your favorite podcasting app. There was a lot of political action in Ottawa this week. Fierce debates about the Middle East, changes to immigration policy, more problems with government contracts. It is definitely March Madness here on the Hill, so let's cover as much ground as we can. Christopher Nardi is a journalist with the National Post. Shannon Proudfoot is a writer with the Globe and Mail. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
I want to start with a big debate that dominated certainly the beginning of the week. The NDP motion on Palestinian statehood had other implications too, sales of military goods to Israel, and that motion changed at the 11th hour. It did pass. What has actually changed for Canada here, Chris?
Tangibly, the government was already, it appears, doing a lot of the things that it agreed to do in the motion. I think there was probably a scramble by the government to get that information out, that it was already doing it, so that it kind of looks like pro forma. I think ultimately in foreign affairs, there's a huge difference between what you're doing quietly and what you do out loud. And when you explicitly say that motion passed, it became parliamentary, the House's will. And now you have to deal with the public, diplomatic consequences of that. And one thing that I've noticed is that in recent weeks, when the prime minister speaks to, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, the head of the Israeli government's cabinet, he doesn't speak to Netanyahu anymore. He speaks to a member of his war cabinet who happens to be an opposition member. I can't say for sure, but it certainly appears like those official communications are dead. And is it because of the motion? Is it because of the series of things that the government has done that Israel absolutely detests? It's unclear. But the fact of the matter is, now that this is said out loud, the world will react openly and out loud as well.
Shannon, I mean, those are some serious implications. There are obviously domestic implications for all of this debate too. What stood out to you as the most meaningful part of all of this?
I found it sort of fundamentally confusing because even the way you framed it up, the kind of banner part of this motion was the recognition of Palestinian statehood. So we saw this play out in a very fraught, very emotional debate, sort of day long. And then at the 11th hour, you know, infamously so fast that they didn't even have a French translation available, there were amendments put forward that fundamentally changed the whole thing, most specifically the recognition of Palestinian statehood, which I think it's accurate to say that's where a lot of the sort of heat and tension around the debate came, with a lot of people arguing that to kind of put that cart before the horse was to reward Hamas for hideous behavior and to kind of advance the negotiated peace process in a way that made no sense to a lot of people. But all of a sudden they stripped that out and then voted for it and it passed. But the essence of what it was all along, it doesn't surprise me that members of the House of Commons felt like at the end of the day, they voted for a thing that they hadn't been talking about all day long. And I think we have yet to sort of hear the internal TikTok of what happened between the Liberals and the NDP, like where this came from and why the motion was still seen as substantive enough to even be worth putting out there because it had been so watered down.
Well, Chris, I mean, I think part of it was avoiding a problem of having this be such a split issue, particularly, we have to acknowledge, for the Liberals. And that's where I want to take this next, because Anthony Housefather was ultimately one of three Liberal MPs who voted against this motion. Now, he says, he's considering his future with the party.
I think it's the first time in my parliamentary career that I've had a reflection like this, where I truly felt last night that a line had been crossed when my party members got up and cheered and gave a standing ovation to Heather McPherson and the NDP. I started reflecting as to whether or not I belonged.
If he leaves, how significant would that be in terms of the message it sends?
Well, that's a tough question. Would it be the most unexpected thing at this rate? He's kind of been telegraphing it since the motion passed. I'm sure, you know, I'll illustrate this. I was in question period on Wednesday during Prime Minister, and I sat in the gallery behind Mr. Housefather to just kind of look at how he was acting. And I noticed at the very end, a number of his colleagues got up and kind of like grabbed his shoulder, said a few words, one gave him a hug. And as they walked away, and I kind of inquired with him, like, what happened there? Are they thinking, are you leaving? And he said, no, they're exhorting me to stay. They're asking me to stay. And so there's obviously a desire not to lose him. He's in an incredibly safe Liberal riding of Mount Royal. So I don't think they're afraid of losing the seat. But I think that they don't want to lose that representation in what is a very traditionally Jewish riding. And to lose one of the kind of more vocal proponents of Israel and the Jewish community in their caucus sends a strong message to the rest of the Jewish community. You don't know what the knock-on effect of that is. He said that he's going to stay in politics. I don't really give a lot of credence to the floor crossing to the Conservatives. But does he become an independent? It's possible. But the Liberals certainly wouldn't want it, even though they're surely not thrilled at like kind of the very overt opposition he's expressed.
Shannon, as we said, a lot happened this week. So I want to switch gears and talk about an announcement this week about immigration numbers, specifically cutting the number of temporary foreign workers the government allows into the country. Here's some of what Immigration Minister Mark Miller had to say about the move.
Canada, like many other countries, has become addicted to temporary foreign workers, but it isn't. It is a more complex story than simply saying that. There can be very damaging consequences if we do this in a rather brute or rough manner without really using a set of tools that are more refined to tailor really what we are trying to attack with what we are actually doing.
Shannon, addicted to foreign workers, how big is the government's problem on this file?
Well, I think there's no doubt that there's been mission creep when it comes to the TFW program. It was originally supposed to be sort of, by and large, for agricultural seasonal workers. And the idea is you can't find anyone in Canada to do this work and to sort of keep the economy ticking, you have to bring them in. And you now see entire sort of fast food franchises staffed by it. Some of this, I think, is a hangover effect of the pandemic when the government they couldn't physically bring more people into the country. So they sort of shifted people over from the temporary category to more permanent. But I find it interesting that we have here a policy response to a policy problem when I think there was a risk that this would slide into sort of xenophobia and scolding. Like, you can imagine a way in which tensions around housing and finite resources in Canada and just a massive uptick in the number of people coming into Canada could spark xenophobia. But equally, I think I could imagine a universe pretty easily where to critique that or to ask questions about whether we're bringing in too many people, if that is genuinely, like, if you're actually asking that on a policy basis, I could imagine people looking down their noses at you and saying, how dare you denigrate our hardworking immigrants or people trying to start a new life here.
So where are we now? You don't feel that we've sort of fallen into either of those categories?
I feel like, no. And happily, I would say, I feel like there's an actual policy response here. There's an actual acknowledgement. I would argue part of that is, I think Mr. Miller's a good communicator and one of the few who's inclined to say mistakes were made. We need to tighten things up. You can hear the sort of spiky language he's using. So it seems to me like there's an acknowledgement of maybe we turn on the taps too wide and we don't have enough housing or resources for the people here, so we're going to dial it back a bit. So it feels to me like we have avoided both of those traps that would have been really kind of corrosive in different ways.
And Chris, it's important to point out that this follows on the limiting the number of international students coming to Canada. So a couple of policy fixes or attempts at fixes. How far does this go towards addressing a political issue here? Because there is fundamentally a political issue, whether you want to say it's about immigration or housing.
Absolutely. You know, we've talked about the general Canadian consensus on immigration, right? And a little bit to what Shannon just said about turning the taps on. What was remarkable to me in the measures that were announced was this idea that we have to review how, where temporary foreign workers go, this market analysis. We're going to include now temporary residents in our immigration levels. This to me is all a tacit, and not at all explicit, but tacit admission by the politicians that the whole thing was a little bit of a Wild West. If we're reassessing the market needs of our temporary foreign workers, it's because we don't know what they are. And if we are not counting, I think, you know, temporary residents are right now 6.2% of the Canadian population. That's over 2.4 million based on 40. If we do not know every year how many we are letting in, like, we are admitting that is a key part of our population growth, and we do not set those levels. So I think that there's a lot of people who reacted to these announcements saying, finally, oh, this makes sense, which would be good news for the government on a political level. But at the same time, I hate to use this expression, but after 8 years of this government...
I think I've heard that line before.
Yeah, but after 8 years, it's crazy that this is only happening now. And not just after 8 years, after every previous government that hasn't done the same thing. The fact that we're not counting temporary residents in our immigration levels until next year is wild to me.
One more issue that I just want to squeeze in here, Shannon. The ArriveCan scandal is still playing out, but this week the government had more contract problems. Ministers announced they referred three cases of suspected fraud to the RCMP. They're alleging double billing by some IT subcontractors to the tune of about $5 million. Now, like ArriveCan, this is not politicians accused of wrongdoing, but does the government wind up wearing all of this all the same?
I would argue that this is sort of a good news story for the government in the sense that they found it. They disclosed it. This didn't come out in some news release that they had to then, or pardon me, a news story that they had to then respond to. They ferreted it out. You have to wonder how much more is out there not being found. But I think there's a massive political risk that this just slides into the arrive can story. Like they are two separate issues, but they sound an awful lot alike, right? Consultants on the take, and already you've seen in the House of consultants allegedly on the take, and already you've seen in the House of Commons Pierre Poilievre being only too happy to kind of wrap them up in a big bundle of scandal. So I think they will end up wearing it to the extent that it sounds like just more of the same, and like who on earth is keeping track of these things.
Okay, it was a pretty intense week for everyone here on Parliament Hill. Thank you both for putting it into perspective for us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Shannon Proudfoot and Chris Nardi. Later today, hundreds will gather in Montreal for the state funeral of Brian Mulroney. Canada's 18th Prime Minister made a significant mark. There were high highs, the biggest majority Canada had ever seen, free trade, helping end South African apartheid. But there were low lows, too, from pushback on the GST to the failure of constitutional talks and historic low popularity. We're going to reflect on Mulroney's impact in a moment, but first, some thoughts from his son, Mark. I sat down with him earlier this week to ask about how his father dealt with those more challenging moments.
I'd be remiss if I said, if I didn't say that, you know, those times were hard for the family because he had so much political capital and he spent it. He didn't think it was something to accumulate and keep in your pockets and take with you to the death. Clearly, he used it. And so when all of these people who had been there turned around and said that it wasn't, that was hard. But it comes down to my mother. My mom was always there for him. And my mom was always there for us, and so was my dad. And we were just a very tightly knit unit. But you're also seeing, as there are people waiting in line, there are hundreds of people who worked for my dad and for my mom and who were there, who basically supported them throughout. And last night we went to a small little drink on the way home back to the hotel, and there was 130 people there. That was just a small portion of the people around the country who were all big believers in the things my dad was doing and that my mom was doing. And all together, you know, that was the support unit, and that support unit has proved to be there even to this day. And I think it's one of the prettiest things to come out of all of this.
You can hear more of my interview with Brian Mulroney's son, Mark, coming up later on CBC Radio. Stay tuned for our special coverage of the state funeral from Montreal. First, though, that legacy. Mulroney left office with historically low opinion polling. He's now being widely praised for his ambition for Canada. Why has opinion changed so much? I'm joined by Daniel Bellan in Montreal. He's the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. And Raymond Blake joins from Regina. He's a professor of history at the University of Regina. Welcome to the house to you both.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks very much.
Now, there are generations of Canadians who don't necessarily know very much about Brian Mulroney. So to start, and Danielle, I'll ask you first, from Sir John A. Macdonald onwards, how consequential was Brian Mulroney's time in office?
I think his time in office was highly consequential for his political and policy successes, but also for some of his big failures.
Raymond, what would you say?
Yeah, any politician, prime minister, can lead people if he follows where they want to go. A great prime minister takes Canadians to where they really didn't think they needed to be. Mulroney did that, and for that reason, he was one of the great nation builders of Canada.
When I last spoke to Brian Mulroney in the fall, he said it was up to historians to judge his legacy. Now, Danielle, I know you're a political scientist, but we'll invite you into the historian family for this discussion. What was the most important decision or event of his political career?
Well, in retrospect, I think, and it was clear at the time that free trade with the United States was a big thing and something that has endured. I mean, then we had NAFTA and now NAFTA 2.0, and actually played a role in renegotiating NAFTA recently during the Trump years. So I think that it's probably the biggest part of his legacy, the most enduring aspect of his legacy, free trade with the United States.
Raymond Blake, what do you think?
I would agree with Danielle, but I would say more than that. I would say that Brian Mulroney prompted Canadians to think about who we are as a nation, who we are as a people. What do we want? What do we value? Where do we want to be, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, now almost 40 years after he was prime minister? So he made us to think seriously about what do we want to be as a nation? What is our national story? And free trade was one key element in that story that he created.
It's so interesting, Raymond Blake, that you say that, because, of course, now, as Daniel referenced, you know, we've had this back and forth with the United States, this attempt to save the free trade agreement, to modernize it. When we look at the coverage back in 1993 of Mulroney's impending exit, one journalist wrote, his policies, notably the 1989 free trade agreement with the United States, are blamed for Canada's sour economy and double-digit unemployment rates. Talk to me a bit about how that evolution has happened.
Well, you know, I think we free trade is the easy one. Everybody sort of applauds Mulroney for free trade, but we have to remember, of course, that in 1988, you know, free trade was seen as the sky is falling in. This is the end of Canada. And many Canadians certainly believed that. And, of course, Mulroney did not win the popular vote in 1988. But if you look at the environment, if you look at social programs, if you look at the old notions of distinct society, if you look at Indigenous people, and Mulroney was probably the first prime minister to talk about Canada as a founding nation, not of French and English, but of three partners in that founding nation. So Mulroney made us think about things that, and move in directions. We're a very conservative nation, and they were very, very resistant Canadians to what Mulroney had to offer. Only later do we see that many of his ideas, many of the elements of his story have come to fruition.
Daniela, I just want to stay with that idea because, you know, his popularity plummeted to a 12% approval rating when he left office, the lowest any prime minister had ever encountered. A recent poll from Spark Insights found 83% of those polled felt he had done a good job as prime minister. How do you make sense of that shift?
Well, first of all, the low popularity, historically low popularity of Brian Mulroney that was in November 1992 at 12% was related to the economic context at the time. There was a recession. Also, or the aftermath of a recession, and that was started in the early 1990s. Also, the GST was very unpopular. Now, the GST is an interesting case of a policy that overall has proved really successful. The Liberals opposed it at first, but when they came to power, they decided to keep it, and that helped. Actually, the Liberals balanced the budget later in the 1990s. So the GST hurt Brian Mulroney and his party, his government, really badly after it was implemented. But today we can see that, you know, the GST, of course, has endured, just like free trade and some other policies enacted during the Mulroney years. I also think that in retrospect, people, are less, I would say, obsessed with, say, the constitutional debate that was so important at the time, Meech and Charlottetown, and that was very divisive at the time. But I think we are not really talking about these issues anymore today. So I think that in hindsight, people have changed their mind about Mulroney, in part because the country has changed so much. And some of the policies that were controversial at the time, like free trade and the GST, are now just part of the landscape of our country, and they are very strongly embedded in our institutions.
Raymond, I wonder what you think about how those attempts to renegotiate the Constitution have shaped the contemporary attitude about whether or not the Constitution is something that a federal politician is willing to touch.
Well, certainly, you know, as Mulroney, you know, he came to my class just a year ago.
Oh, wow.
And you know, one of the things that we talked about was how many of the ideas around distinct society, sort of giving more power to the provinces as sort of a decentralized nation, have all come to pass in many ways. But, you know, one of the things that Mulroney, we hear in the last few days, certainly his warmth, his generosity, his grace even. But, you know, as Dalton Camp, an old conservative backrooms fixer, once said, you know, Brian Mulroney could give up many things, you know, when he was younger, drinking and partying and so on. But Dalton Camp said, And he was absolutely right. Mulroney could not give up hyperbole. And so Mulroney was sometimes his own worst enemy. Some of the comments he made about giving civil servants, you know, pink slips and running shoes, you know, rolling the dice, tearing up the Meech Lake Accord in front of a national audience and tossing it in the air. He had a way of sort of getting under people's skin. And even though in private and as a campaigner, he was very, very good. But he sometimes just roiled people, and Canadians didn't like what they see because, and of course we never talk about universality. What a scandal that created, what an uproar it created when he was going to get rid of family allowances and give social programs to what he called those in need and not wealthy bank presidents. And Canadians were worried about some of those things, although many of those things, as we saw most recently, you know, with PharmaCare, these are all income-tested measures that 25, 30 years ago we just thought would be the end of the Social Security system that we had built since the Second World War.
Daniel, I want to come back to you on that question of the Constitution, because I do think that whenever we approach an issue, be it Senate reform or anything else, and there is this question of, well, that would require reopening the Constitution, it really does seem to be a no-go zone now. Should we understand that as being part of an enduring fatigue from Brian Mulroney's attempts to change things?
I think so. When I said at the very beginning that the Mulroney era, Brian Mulroney shaped Canada through his successes, but also his failures, and I think the failures of Meech and Charlottetown have created the chilling effect within the political class in terms of not reopening the Constitution because it's perceived really as a Pandora box. And we know what happened with Brian Mulroney. I mean, Lake Meech could have worked. It was agreed upon in 1997, just a room with the premiers behind closed doors. They reached this agreement. It was not ratified by all the provinces after 3 years in the end, but it could have succeeded, but it failed. And because of this failure and what happened later with Charlottetown, it's perceived as very, very risky for a Canadian prime minister to even think about utter the idea that you could open the Constitution. That's why all the prime ministers ever since have refused to even engage with this idea. Even when the Quebec government under Mr. Couillard, Premier Couillard, begged or wrote to Justin Trudeau to ask him to reconsider maybe opening the constitutional debate again, Justin Trudeau just said no.
In closing, I'd like to ask you, in that spirit, what do you think is one more part of his legacy that is impacting politicians today, future generations of politicians?
You know, it's interesting that Mr. Justin Trudeau said a few days ago, you know, a prime minister must make unpopular choices when he's talking about the tax on carbon. And, you know, that now has become sort of a part of our mindset. I almost like to walk in the snow of this leap year. And what we see, I think, is prime ministers, when they get into trouble now, may very well say, you know, to be a good leader, I have to make tough decisions. And, you know, that was Mulroney's mantra for a very long time. But we saw with him, he really did try to make and did make some very critical changes in the nation. And he wasn't rewarded for most of them during his time in office.
Daniel Bellin?
Yeah, someone who took enormous risks, who was, you know, took really bold actions. Some of them failed miserably and created a major chilling effect, as I mentioned, in terms of constitutional debates. But there are also great successes. But some of them, some of these policy successes at first were they didn't pay off politically. That was the case of the GST. But we may think that in some, you know, a few decades from now, maybe that carbon pricing will be like the GST, something that's really embedded in our institutions if the current government sticks to it. But, you know, this is the thing that often you have to make tough choices in politics and they are not always popular. And I think the Mulroney years show that sometimes unpopular decisions, or controversial decisions at least, in the long run can pay off for the country.
Thank you both so much for sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Daniel Bellin of McGill and Raymond Blake of the University of Regina. Brian Mulroney was famous for his phone calls, using his charm not just on friends, but people across the political spectrum. Earlier this week, I was up on Parliament Hill to ask MPs what advice or inspiration they got from Brian Mulroney, starting with Conservative MP Gerard Deltel.
Never surrender. Never surrender. And when time is tough, believe in your policy. If you strongly believe in the policy and you think that the policy is good, move forward. Because this is what you think for. And this is what you fight for. And yes, in democracy, it's part of the game to see people being upset, being opposed to you, opposed to your ideas. But if you believe in your idea, fight on. Never surrender. Continue the hard job. But also be close to your family.
My dad talked a lot about Brian Mulroney with regards to Nelson Mandela. And in my household, and in many households across Canada, in fact around the world, people saw the former Prime Minister for that piece of work, for so much more, but that piece of work, and how he stood, and stood alone, and said, this is not right, and we as Canada are going to do something about this.
I think, you know, if you look at our own leader of the time, Ed Broadbent, and certainly they had very passionate debates and were very much on opposite political ends of the spectrum, but there was still a measure of decorum and respect there that you could leave the fight on the floor of the House of Commons and still go and be friends after the end of the day. So I think that's something that we should all sort of take notice of and maybe try to aspire to.
I was a young kid growing up in Alberta when he was elected in 84 and then again in 88, and I served as parliamentary guide here on the Hill in 1990. And that was the summer that Canada welcomed Queen Elizabeth II, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Nelson Mandela. And there was a moment I was in the center block, and Prime Minister Mulroney was coming down the steps with Nelson Mandela. And he looked at all of us guys and he says, "It's a great day, isn't it?" And then he saw that I had my camera out. And he gave me a wink and he said, "Make sure it's a good one," and then turn Mr. Mandel into the frame of my camera. I got the photo and I still have it, and I'll never forget that day.
In my brief encounters with him, I discovered how important it is to have a warm personal touch, to invest in yourself, in the person you're engaging with, whoever it might be, whether they're earlier in their career or later on. And how important I think that is in the age of disruption to come. I think this is a time in which we see a lot of trust that's broken across many parts of our country. And I'm excited to think that his legacy of freedom and of decency is something that will live on in a generation to come.
That was Conservative MP Shiv Majumdar. You also heard the voices of Liberal Cabinet Ministers Randy Boissonneau and Marcy Ian, and the NDP's Alistair McGregor. Okay, that's it for us this week. Our team on the House is Kristen Everson, Emma Godmere, Christian Pauslang, and our senior producer is Jennifer Chevalier. Special thanks this week to Kenny Sharp in St. John's. I'm Catherine Cullen. Join us again next week, and thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.